As I said last night when David asked me, I want to talk about one another. One another is one of the great theologies of the Bible. There are probably 10 to 15 different concepts surrounding one another. We are to do this, one another. We are to do that, one for another. And tonight I want to take the time to look at a couple of those. But as way of introduction, I am going to read for you a rather lengthy reading by our standards from the pulpit. It's not a lengthy reading in terms of speech, but it is a commencement address that a man by the name of George Saunders is a professor at Syracuse University, and he was asked to give the 2013 commencement address to the graduates at Syracuse. So this was given probably about 13 months ago, assuming that would have been about May. It immediately went viral. If any of you are interested, you can get it on YouTube and hear him give it to you live. I don't have that technology or that inclination, so I'm going to read it. His commencement address was scheduled to be 13 minutes long. He said, and as I was watching an interview someone did with him a couple of weeks ago, that just before he went out to give it, someone came to him and said, "We're running behind. You need to cut it from 13 to 8, which he did. And he attributes maybe some of its popularity to the fact that he cut it down. Most of us could probably cut most of our exhortations in half and not only not miss too much, maybe improve it. That probably won't happen tonight. But I am going to read it for you, and I know that sometimes readings are a little tedious, but I just found this to be quite on point for what I want to say tonight. I don't know this man, but I suspect, being a professor at a major university, the chances of him being Christian are relatively small. But he did articulate himself well. I would say he's probably in his mid-50s now, just judging by watching him. So I'm going to read it, and then that will be an introduction to my thoughts tonight. Down through the ages, a traditional form has evolved for this type of speech, which is some old guy, his best years behind him, who, over the course of life, has made a series of dreadful mistakes, that would be me, gives heartfelt advice to a young, shining, energetic young people with all their best years ahead of them, that would be you, and I intend to respect that tradition. Now, one useful thing that you can do with an old person, in addition to borrowing money from them, is ask, looking back, what do you regret? And they will tell you. Sometimes they'll tell you even if you ask them not to tell them, even when you specifically requested that they not. So, he said, what do I regret? Being poor from time to time? Not really. Working terrible jobs like being a knuckle puller in a slaughterhouse? (Parentheses, don't even ask what that is. No, I don't regret that. Swimming in a river in Sumatra and looking up and seeing 300 monkeys sitting on a pipeline, defecating into the river when I was swimming in and getting deathly ill afterwards? No, I don't regret that. Do I regret occasional humiliation, like once playing hockey in front of a big crowd, including a girl I really liked, and I somehow managed when falling to emit this weird whooping noise? No, I don't regret that. But here's something I do regret. In the seventh grade, this new kid joined our class. In the interest of confidentiality, we will call her Ellen. Ellen was small, shy. She wore those blue cat's eye glasses that at that time only old ladies wore. When nervous, which was pretty much always, she had a habit of taking a strand of her hair and putting it into her mouth and chewing on it. So she came to our school, she came to our neighborhood, and was mostly ignored and occasionally teased with something like, "Does your hair taste good?" I could see that that hurt her, and I still remember the way she looked after such an insult. Eyes cast down, a little gut kicked, as if having just been reminded of her place in the order of things. She was trying as much as possible to disappear. After a while, she drifted away, hair strands still in her mouth. At home, I imagine after school, her mother would say, "How was your day?" And she'd say, "Fine." And her mother would say, "Making any friends?" And she'd say, "Sure, lots." Sometimes I'd see her hanging around alone in her front yard as if afraid to leave it. And then they moved. That was it. No tragedy. No big final hazing. One day she was there. The next day she wasn't. End of story. So why do I regret that? 42 years later, why am I still thinking about it? Relative to most of the other kids, I guess I was actually relatively nice to her. I never said an unkind word to her, and in fact, I sometimes even tried to mildly defend her, but it still bothers me. So here's something I know to be true, although a little corny, and I don't quite know what to do with it. What I regret most in my life are failures of kindness. Those moments when another human being was there in front of me suffering and I responded reservedly, mildly if at all. Or to look at it from the other end of the telescope, who in your life do you remember most fondly with those undeniable feelings of warmth? Those who were kindest to you, I bet. It's a little facile. Maybe, and certainly hard to implement, but I'd say as a goal in life, you could do worse than try to be kinder. Now the million-dollar question, what's our problem? Why aren't we kinder? Well, here's what I think, he said. Each of us is born with a series of built-in confusions that are probably somewhat Darwinian. These are, number one, that we are central to the universe. That is, our personal story is the main and most interesting story. Really, it's the only story. Number two, that we are separate from the universe. There's the U.S., and then out there, all that other junk. Dogs, swing sets, the state of Nebraska, low-hanging clouds, and you know, other people. And three, that we are permanent. Death is real, okay, sure, but that's for you, not for me. Now, we don't really believe those things, he said. Intellectually, we know better. But we believe them viscerally, and we live by them. And they cause us to prioritize our own needs over the needs of others, even though we really want, in our hearts, to be less selfish and more aware of what's actually happening in the present moment, more open to be more loving. So the second million-dollar question is, how might we do this? How might we become more loving, more open, less selfish, more present, less delusional, etc., etc., etc.? Well, let me just say this. There are ways. And you already know that because in your life there have been high kindness periods and low kindness periods. And you know what inclined you toward the former and away from the latter. Education is good. Immersing ourselves in a work of art, that's good. Prayer is good. Meditation is good. A frank talk with a dear friend. Establishing ourselves in some kind of spiritual tradition. Recognizing there have been countless really smart people before us who have asked the same question and left behind answers for us. Because kindness, it turns out, is hard. It starts out all rainbows and puppy dogs and expands to include, well, everything. One thing on our favor, some of this becoming kinder seems to happen naturally with age. It might be a simple matter of attrition. As we get older, we come to see how useless it is, to be selfish, how illogical it really is. We come to love other people and are therefore counter-instructed into our own centrality. We get kicked by real life, and people come to our defense and help us, and we learn that we are not separate, we are not alone, And we don't want to be. We see people near and dear to us dropping away and are gradually convinced that maybe we too will drop away someday, a long time from now. Most people, as they age, he said, become less selfish and more loving. I think this to be true. The poet Hayden Carruth said in a poem written near the end of his life that he was mostly loved now. So a prediction and my heartfelt wish for you, as you get older, yourself will diminish and you will grow in love. You will gradually be replaced by love. If you have kids, that will be a huge moment in your process of self-diminishment. You really don't care what happens to you as long as they're okay and benefit. That's one reason your parents are so proud of you today. One of their fondest dreams has come true. You have accomplished something difficult and tangible, and that has enlarged you as a person and will make your life better from here on forever. When young, we're anxious, understandably, to find out if we've got what it takes. Can we succeed? Can we build a viable life for ourselves? But you, in particular you of this generation, may have noticed a certain cyclic quality to ambition. You do well in high school in hopes of getting into college or getting a good job. And this is actually okay. If we're going to become kinder, the process has to include taking ourselves seriously as doers, as accomplishers, as dreamers. We have to do that to be our best selves. Still, accomplishment is unreliable. Succeeding, whatever that might mean to you, is hard, and the need to do so constantly renews itself. Success is like a mountain that keeps growing ahead of you as you hike up it. And there's a real danger that succeeding will take up your whole life, while the big questions, the truly important questions, go unattended. So a quick end-of-speech advice. Since, according to me, your life is going to be, or should be, a gradual process of becoming kinder and more loving, hurry up. Speed it along. Start right now. There is a confusion in each of us, a sickness, really a selfishness. But there's also a cure. So be a good and proactive and even somewhat desperate patient on your own behalf, and seek out the most efficacious anti-selfish medicines energetically for the rest of your life. Do all the other things, the ambitious things, travel, get famous, innovate, lead, fall in love, make and lose fortunes, swim in a jungle river, but as you do, to the extent you can, err in the direction of kindness. Do those things that incline you toward the big questions, and avoid the things that reduce you and make you trivial. The luminous part of you that exists beyond personality, your soul, if you will, is as bright and shining as any that has ever been, bright as any other. Clear away everything that keeps you separate from this secret illumination. Believe it exists and come to know it better. Nurture it and share its fruits tirelessly. Someday, in 80 years, when you're 100 and I'm 134, and we're both so kind and loving we're almost unbearable, drop me a line and let me know how your life has been. I hope you will say, it has been wonderful. That went viral within 24 hours of it being delivered. George Saunders had no idea that it would go viral. And I don't know anything about the man other than he wrote this. And I know what he looks like because I saw him on TV. But I thought that was a rather amazing commencement address for a secular institution. I might say it might make an amazing sermon for the church. As I watched his interview on public television, as he went through this, and I Googled it and read it, Romans chapter 12, verse 10, just overtook me. Be kindly affectionate one to another. This wasn't anything original in thought by George Saunders. He's now turned it into a short book. If you want to buy it, that's fine. I won't. I've got what I wanted, pretty. But kindness and compassion is a key essential element of being a true human being. It is also a key essential element of being a child of God. Why aren't we more kind? I think sometimes we get trapped in these cells that we are created with our thoughts and our physicality. What you are is largely what you think you are, at least in practicality, not in reality. But to vigilantly patrol the borders of ourselves, if we're not careful, we end up being a little selfish and therefore less kind. We live based upon our own centrality, as he said, that we're at the center of what happens and everything revolves around us, even though intellectually we know that's folly. We see ourselves as separate or above rather than part of humanity and our surroundings. Seeing ourselves as solid in the way that reality isn't true. Maybe seeing some of the biblical principles that we know are in the Bible to apply to everyone but us, or more intensely to others than to us. And at the end of life, we get this bill for all of this false thinking, this unkind life, not intentionally unkind, just sloppily unkind. And we have forget that we have a responsibility to those around us. I believe this is probably exacerbated in our decade by our digital environment. A digital culture that makes kindness rarer than it used to be. A digital culture that fails to think of one another as fellow human beings and rather thinks of one another as things on the other end of some digital device. You know, that's one of the reasons the Amish don't believe in the telephone. Now, they will use it in some cases in emergency, but I was reading some of the writings of some of the Amish fathers, and their primary objection, to the telephone is that it decreases face-to-face human contact. And it does. We talk more, but we interact less. And an untested virtue is not a virtue. Therefore, kindness and compassion has to first be tested for it to be virtuous. As I said, I want to look at a couple of the one another concepts in the Bible, and they surround or take a pivotal point from this concept of kindness. And the first one, I will go to Galatians chapter 5 to extract. This is not the only passage from which we could extract it, but it is one of the better ones. In Galatians chapter 5, really it's the first 13 verses, but I'll allow you to read the 11 of them on your own. In the first verse of Galatians 5, it says, "Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made us free, and be not entangled again with the yoke of bondage." Then verse 13, "For brethren, we have been called into liberty, only use not liberty as an occasion for the flesh, but by love serve one another." We are set free to serve. We are no longer slaves to sin so that we can be slaves to the Lord. Being set free in the context that I believe Paul and the other New Testament writers present it is a lot different than being turned loose. It's not, in fact, that at all. Some of you are old enough to remember, and I guess they still exist in rare occasions, what we used to call full-service gas stations. You would go in, they would not only pump your gas, they would wash your windshield, they would check your oil if you wanted them to, they would even check your tires. If those things exist anymore, and I haven't been in one for many, many years, I'm sure that you pay for it at the per gallon price. I don't mind that we don't have full-service gas stations anymore, but we do need to be full-service Christians. In God's kingdom, it's the servant, not the celebrity, and not the master, that he most cherishes. That's why Jesus tells us in Mark chapter 10, verse 31, the first shall be last, the last shall be first. Elsewhere, we are told that the least shall be the greatest, and the greatest shall be the least. And it all hinges on this concept of serving one another through kindness and through compassion. What does Christian serving mean? How would we define that? I found that a little more difficult than one might think, so it got rather lengthy. Whenever you have trouble defining something concisely, it means you're really kind of struggling, I think, with what its definition is. So maybe this will prove I'm still struggling, but this is the best I have so far. Christian serving is the willingness to humble oneself and act for the benefit of another in the name of Christ. It's an attitude followed by an action that wants to better or facilitate the improvement or condition of another person. It's assisting in a way that betters another spiritually or circumstantially. It's the coming alongside like the paraclete, therefore being godlike. That seems to me to be what Paul has in mind when he says, serve one another. And God does call us to service. He has created us, Ephesians chapter 2, verse 10, unto good works. I do not believe, as a Christian, it is a good work unless it glorifies God. It might be a good thing to do, but if we do it absent of it glorifying God, I think much of its good, if not all of its good, is lost. What we do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord. President Kennedy, in his inaugural speech, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. There are many benefits to being an American, but they pale to the benefits of being a Christian. Freedom allows us to maximize our potential. That's what it's all about. We're not turned loose. We're free to maximize our potential. One man used that application, I thought it was rather interesting, on tithing. He said, we don't have to tithe anymore, we can give more. Usually when people say, must we tithe, they're thinking, can we give less? But Jesus didn't die on the cross to keep us slaves to ourselves, but to free us to be servants. Service is our ticket out of slavery. And we're free to become what God not only wants us to be, but knows that each one of us can be. You ever been, and I know this is a rhetorical question, ever been on the highway and one lane closes and you'll be going and it'll say, right lane's going to close a little bit ahead. And you're in the right lane. What do you do? You start looking for someone nice enough to let you in. You're looking for someone to serve you. Well, maybe that's a minute point. Every one of us has probably been in a situation where we weren't finding anybody to serve us and we were kind of scrunched. But eventually, I guess we got in the left lane because we're here. But let's redo that story. The right lane's going to close, but you're in the left lane. You ever accelerate so that the car beside you can't get in ahead of you? Now, I know there are these irritating people that just go down as far as they can, okay, and you want to blow their cars up. That's okay. My illustration is we want so bad to be served when we're in the right lane, and we're sometimes rather hesitant to serve others from the left lane. The ministry of service. It requires humility. That's what John 13 is all about, the washing of the feet. Maybe their feet were dirty, maybe they weren't. That's irrelevant. It was a humility of service. That was the lesson. And we've been washed by the blood of Christ. That's a lot better than just having your feet washed. Because we live in a dirty world, don't we? And therefore, to wash each other's feet, to serve, washing of feet being the metaphor, to help each other stay and get clean. Our vertical relationship to God is tied to our foot washing of others. I believe God serving us is tied to our willingness to serve others, just like God's forgiveness of us is tied to our willingness to forgive others. But there's another one another, if you will, that I'd like to look at tonight before my time gets away from me. And that is found in 2 Corinthians. Particularly, I will be looking at chapter 1, verses 3 through 7. 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 3 through 7. I'm going to read those five verses. And I will try to count for you, but you can also count how many times the word comfort is used in those few verses. 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 3. Blessed be God, even the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and the God of all comfort, who comforteth us in all of our tribulation, that we may be able to comfort them that are in any trouble by the comfort wherein we ourselves are comforted of God. I've got two verses and five comforts. For as the sufferings of Christ abound in us, so our comfort also abounds by Christ. And whether we be afflicted, it is for your comfort and salvation, which is effectual in the enduring of the same sufferings which we also suffer. Or whether we be comforted, it is for your comfort and salvation. And our hope of you is steadfast, knowing that ye are partakers of the sufferings, that ye shall also be comforted. 10 times in 5 verses. Now, if you were reading from the King James, sometimes it said consolation rather than comfort, and I made that transition because I believe those are synonymous terms. 10 times in 5 verses, Paul talks about comfort. A little bit, we'll look at some subsequent verses in this book, and we'll see that it is Paul that not only comforts, but Paul who needed the comfort. And comfort is needed because afflictions come. Afflictions are the pains of life. Because we're simply occupants here, and sometimes difficulties come our way. I don't know, but it's high. What percentage of the mail that comes to our home says either resident or occupant? Now, I get some mail with my name on it, but I get a lot of mail that's to resident and occupant. I didn't ask for it. I don't particularly want it. It usually doesn't get opened unless I can see through the window that there's quarters or a dollar bill in it. I just get it because I'm an occupant. You get it because you're an occupant. Pain and afflictions come to us sometimes simply because we're an occupant of this world. We didn't ask for them. We didn't do anything to cause them necessarily. We didn't necessarily deserve them. It just comes with being an occupant. Every Christian gets junk mail. Every Christian also gets afflictions. No matter what our hardest moments are, however, God is always there to comfort us. That's one of Paul's points. So that we can comfort one another. That's a point we will see brought out in a passage in just a moment. Our pain is difficult and hurtful, but it's not just about us. Remember in the commencement address, he talked about how we get so centered about everything being about us. Everything centers around us. Even our pain and afflictions really don't center around us. As part of God's family, our hurts, our difficulties are not to be dealt with alone. They should not be dealt with alone, and we really don't want them to be dealt with alone. I mentioned this at Vandalia Sunday afternoon, so a couple of you that were there will just bear with this. I don't really mind going to the doctor, but I don't like going to the doctor. But sometimes it's simply the better choice of whatever. You ever gone to the doctor and then he says, well, this is what's wrong, and then he gives you those classic words, this is going to hurt a little bit. Yeah. A few years ago, I had some real difficulty or potential difficulty with my eye. I went to the doctor, he diagnosed it, he said, we can at least stop it. We're going to give you 4 injections in your eyeball. I just couldn't wait for that. I just thanked him profusely. It sounds worse than it is. No, it's terrible. It sounds worse than it is simply because your eyeball doesn't have a lot of nerve endings. It has some, but not a lot. But I did it. And you've had similar things. Maybe it wasn't your eye, it was something else. You did it because you knew it had to hurt so you could get better. The same is true in life. Sometimes it has to hurt before it can get better. We sing about the great physician. Sometimes we just need to step back and let the great physician do his work. I trust my doctor, so I don't argue with him. I trust my Lord. Shouldn't argue with him either. Sometimes that's what's needed to get comfort. God is in the pain-curing business. And he tells us to be in the pain-curing business, so he tells us, comfort one another. There's a wonderful passage in Isaiah chapter 42. I just want to read it for you. In Isaiah chapter 42, verses 2 and 3, Isaiah writes this. Isaiah 43, verses 2 and 3. When you pass through the waters, this is God speaking, I will be with you. And you pass through the rivers, they shall not overtake you. When you walk through the fire, thou shalt not be burned, neither shall the flame kindle upon thee. For I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel. I am your Savior. I gave you Egypt for my ransom, Ethiopia and Seba before thee. He was telling his children, I'm going to be with you. And I don't find anywhere in Scripture for that has been rescinded. We've all seen maybe live illustrations of this, or at least on TV, where a stuntman bursts into flames. And then it's done in a movie or theatrical sense. And then at the end, he comes out and he's fine. Well, we understand that because he has a protective coating or garment around him that can allow flames to come off of it, but it doesn't burn him. I think that's a good analogy for us as Christians. We have a protective God around us. In Job chapter 1, it's called a hedge that protects us if we will simply let it. Sometimes we need to let our pain drive us toward God. I am really convinced that after this life is over, many of us will, and it's hard to understand this now probably, many of us will wish we had hurt more, mentally, physically, psychologically, because those things have a great capacity to drive us nearer to God. Do I wish that on me or you? No, that's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying they can be that benefit. But sometimes the walking through affliction is rather tedious. I have the privilege of being in many homes, and many times when I'm in a home, they will have a treadmill. Oftentimes it has several half inches of dust on it. It hadn't been used for a while. But sometimes they're in use. But it's very common for me to see in a home that has a treadmill, there will be a radio or a TV or a book stand in front of that treadmill. Why? Because walking on a treadmill, it's probably kind of boring. Or you'll see a jogger with their iPads or podcasts or whatever they're listening to. Something to distract them through the tedium. Well, sometimes life is tedious. That's why we need to be focused on God. That's our positive distraction, if you will. How does God comfort us? Well, one of the ways I believe God comforts us is by bringing comforters into our lives. That's why he said, comfort one another. Other Christians who can comfort us when we need it, and other Christians whom we can comfort when they need it. I believe the Lord uses the family of God to comfort the family of God, and I believe we can show that with numerous illustrations in Scripture. I won't turn to this one, but in Luke chapter 22, verses 31 and 32, Jesus looks at Peter and he says, Satan wants to have you. And then he says, I'm praying that you will be converted or restored. But the last phrase in verse 32 is fascinating. So that you may be able to restore others. What was Jesus saying to Peter? You're going through a hard time. I'm praying that you get through it. But one of the things I think will happen when you get through it is you'll be in a better position to help others. Some of you have gone through things that I have not gone through. I will never go through. I don't want to go through them. But you can talk and comfort other people as they go through those things in ways I can't. I can sympathize. You can empathize. And there is quite a difference. Someone who has lost a child, I can't go up and say, I know how you feel, because I don't know how you feel. I can say, I'm sorry. So if you become a comforter, you've got a better chance of being comforted. If you refuse to be a comforter, you have, I think, a poorer chance of being comforted. Because it is a reciprocal thing within the family of God. In 2 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 5, 6, and 7, we have Paul saying in very concise terms what I said in probably rather wordy terms. 2 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 5. For when we were come unto Macedonia, our flesh had no rest. We were dog-tired. But we were troubled on every side, and without were fightings, and within were fears. Nevertheless, God, that comforted those who are cast down, comforted us. Now listen how he says God comforted him. Comforted us by the coming of Titus. Verse 7. And not by his coming only, but by the comfort or consolation wherewith he was comforted by you. Now what are those verses telling us? The brethren here comforted Titus, which gave Titus the insight or the strength or the courage or whatever to come and comfort Paul. See, comfort is a contagious, cyclical thing. The brethren at Corinth comforted Paul because by comforting Titus, that allowed Titus to come and comfort Paul. You might comfort Johnny, which allows him to be in a position to go comfort Bob, which allows Bob to be in a position to go comfort Earl, which makes Earl in a position to go comfort Neil and let that chain never end. And you know, we, you and I, who maybe started the comfort, might be the recipients of it somewhere down the line. And in fact, we will. If we only think of ourselves, much of the comfort is lost. It's missed. And we should be looking for comforting opportunities not only because it's the right thing to do, but it's a little bit in our best interest. But too often we're like bubble wrap that can never be reused. You pop it and it's gone. I believe when the church comforts one another as the scriptures teach us, then we begin to have real Christianity. Joni Erickson, who's paraplegic from an accident when she was a young lady, said this one sentence: sometimes God allows what he hates in order to accomplish what he loves. I think sometimes God allows us to hurt, not because he likes to see us hurt, but he knows something even grander can come out of that as we comfort one another. Often want to feel, follow Jesus and you won't have any problems. Well, that's not true. We're Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. God doesn't say that these things won't happen. He just says, I'll be there to hold your hand when you go through them. They don't have them in, I don't think they have them in Des Moines. They don't have them in Kansas City on the freeways. But in the larger areas, cities, Los Angeles, Chicago, Atlanta, the left lane of freeways that are usually 3 to 7 or 8 lanes, they have what is called an HOV lane. I know what it's for. I've known what it's for years, but I never knew what it meant. I didn't know what HOV was. When I found out what it meant, I thought, that is a wonderful analogy for us. HOV stands for High Occupancy Vehicle. And it means you need, it's for carpooling. You got to have 2 or 3 or however many, it'll tell you, in order to get in that lane, and you go faster, theoretically. We are to be a high occupancy group. We're not supposed to go it alone. We're supposed to carpool in a metaphorical sense. We're to be there together. And when we do, we get in the fast lane. I'm not talking about speed, I'm talking about the lane to heaven. We read Psalms for encouragement. Why? Because Psalms is full of pain. We read David's anguish in Psalms 32, 34, 52. You pick one. Why? Because we get comfort from that, even though it includes pain. Paul was a great spiritual man. But if I go back to 2 Corinthians chapter 1, where I was, and read a couple of more verses, he says in verse 8, for we would not, brethren, have you to be ignorant of our trouble, which came to us in Asia, that we were pressed out of measure, above strength, insomuch that we despaired for life. Now, I can't stand up here and tell you Paul was suicidal, because I don't believe he was, because he understood the ramifications of that. But this guy was so depressed, he was tired of living. Probably why he says in Philippians 1, for me to die would be gain. But if God has work for me to do, that's fine. If Paul can get to such despair as that, it shouldn't surprise me or shouldn't surprise you that we can on occasion get to it. So what does Paul do? He turns to his brethren and to the Lord for comfort. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful example. Paul's thorn in the flesh that he later saw as a blessing. How many want to grow close to God without the weakness that is required to get there? You and I are never going to get close to God strong. We're only going to get close to God weak. Then once we get to God weak, then we can become strong. But so often people want to get to God strong, that only makes one weak. Grandma didn't always have the thermometers and the timers on her oven that are available today. But I can remember her, and you can maybe remember your grandmother, would pull that roast out of the oven and she would poke it with a fork. And then she'd stick it back in. 15 minutes later, she'd do it. Poke it with a fork. She'd stick it back in. Finally, she had poked it with the fork and it was ready. And out it would come. And boy, was it good. Well, I'm not sure God doesn't do that with us. Sometimes he has to poke me with a fork to see if I'm ready. Ready to serve. And I'm not always. So he puts me back in whatever he's got for me, and well, later he'll poke me somehow. Maybe eventually we get done. We get ready to serve. It takes affliction. It takes irritation to make a pearl. But the secretion that comforts that irritation ends up to be a beautiful thing. The secretions that comfort us in our times of need are more precious than any pearl, aren't they? I want to just close with one final verse. It's found in Job 42. I think Johnny told me this congregation is in the process of starting a study on Job. Good. You're a long way from chapter 42, but in 2 or 3 years when you get there, maybe you'll remember this. No, it won't take you that long, but Job's a long book. I have studied Job numerous times. I know the story well. You know the story well, so I don't have to tell you the story. But until it was recently pointed out to me, there's a verse that I think is one of the keys to the book of Job that I had missed. That's beautiful about studying the Bible, isn't it? In chapter 42, verse 10. Now, Job had it all taken away from him except his life. And you know, finally the Lord restored it. Even more so. But listen to verse 10. The Lord turned the captivity or the anguish of Job when he prayed for his friends. And the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. Did you catch it? When did God restore Job? When Job prayed for his friends. Could it be that the whole restoration fulcrum of Job hinged on when Job quit looking at himself and started praying for other people? I don't know any other way to interpret that verse. And were I a better scholar of the Bible, I would have noticed it long before. Maybe I'm just catching up with you. And the Lord turned the captivity of Job when he prayed for his friends. I think maybe one of the great comforts that we can have is to comfort others. It can really make us feel wonderful. And I know many of you do it with great regularity. But something that makes us feel that good, why don't we all do it so much more? So much more. There's a lot to one another theology in the Bible. That's just a glimpse, a scratching of the surface of two, serving one another and comforting one another. But I do think George Sanders brought a valid point to our attention when he said, do all the other things. You can travel. Maybe you'll get famous. Maybe you'll fall in love. But as you do, to the extent you can, err in the direction of kindness. Now, he doesn't think kindness is an error. He's putting that in there as a for emphasis. Err in the point of kindness. Be kindly affectionate one to another. I think God's got it right. We just need to get in the saddle and follow. We're going to close our thoughts this evening. We're going to extend the gospel invitation. Neil has selected a song. One of the wonderful things about being in the family certainly is our salvation, but it's the comfort we get one from another. It's when we're hurting, there's someone there to be there. Maybe that's all there is to do, is to be there, but that's a lot. That's a lot. You and I live in neighborhoods. We live in communities that a lot of people don't have at their disposal what God has given us. They could, but they don't. If we can help anybody in any way tonight, if we can help comfort one another, the ultimate comfort is to have our sins washed away, isn't it? But that's not all this invitation is about. It could be asking for prayers. It could be sharing of a hardship. I don't know. But I do know the Bible says, serve one another and comfort one another. The invitation is extended as we stand and sing.